The headlines this hour. The top-ranking Iranian commander says that his country is yet to fully take its harsh revenge for the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in 2020. Italy tightens restrictions on people unvaccinated against COVID-19 by barring them from entering restaurants or taking domestic flights under new rules coming into force Monday. And the fire sweeps through a refugee camp for Rohingya Muslims in Bangladesh, leaving thousands of people without shelter. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warns that part of the country's harsh revenge still awaits the U.S. for the assassination of top General Qasem Soleimani in 2020. IRGC Commander Major General Hossein Salami says that Iran's missile strikes on Edel Assad military base in Iraq was only part of the response. Salami says that Washington should know that it cannot launch an act of aggression against the nation and avoid its retaliation. He says that Iran is not daunted by enemies and will defend its independence. Salami's comments come days after the second anniversary of Soleimani's assassination in the U.S. drone strike. Iran responded by hitting the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad with over a dozen missiles. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has held talks with his Omani counterpart in Muscat as part of his one-day visit to the Arab nation. Amir Abdollahian and Saeed Badr al-Busaidi have discussed key regional issues and ways to promote ties between the two countries. Upon his arrival in Muscat, the top Iranian diplomat described ties between the two nations as long-lasting and sustainable. Amir Abdollahian said that his country is seeking to enhance relations with its neighbors, including those in the Persian Gulf region. As the Vienna talks to revive the 2015 deal continue, Iran says it wants to make sure that the U.S. does not treat the JCPOA with contempt again.
Iran and the U.S. have exchanged views through unofficial written texts on four issues. Those are ensuring the effective removal of sanctions, nuclear commitments, the issue of verification, and obtaining guarantees that no other U.S. administration in Washington would make a mockery of international relations and this agreement.
Khatibzadeh says the Vienna talks only focus on the full, responsible, and verifiable U.S. return to the deal. The Iranian official said that Iran seeks a lasting and reliable agreement, but the talks have made good progress so far. However, he stressed that Iran alone cannot maintain the pace of the negotiations and wants the other side to speed up its efforts. Vienna is currently hosting the eighth round of talks between Iran and the other remaining parties to the JCPOA, namely Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and is not directly involved in the talks. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Tomaleski at the venue of the talks in Vienna. She gave us an update on the eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 agreement in the Austrian capital.
Meetings are planned for later this evening or late in the afternoon between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, and his Russian and Chinese counterparts, separate meetings with them, as well as other meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the JCPOA and the EU coordinator Enrico Mora. And these meetings between the heads of delegations have been going on since the eighth round of these talks began. Up until this stage, we are hearing some positive notes coming from various parties. Or, for instance, Mr. Bagheri himself saying that things are moving forward and that the atmosphere is that the atmosphere is positive, or as European officials like to put it, businesslike or serious. So there is intense work taking place now, and at the moment, talks are still continuing on the two issues of sanctions removal, one working group on that issue and another working group on Iran's nuclear commitments.
Meanwhile, political analyst Mohammad Mirandi says that the U.S. and the European sides in the Vienna talks are asking Iran to give new concessions in order to revive the 2015 deal.
Well, so far the Europeans and the Americans are all behaving like hawks. They want the same thing that Trump wants from Iran. They want appeasements. They want the Iranians to give new concessions, and that's not doable. The Iranians sent a heavyweight delegation. and many technical experts from the central bank and other bureaucratic institutions in the government to find a solution and find a formula. And they have presented mechanisms to the Americans through the Europeans and to the Europeans directly that could be a solution. But the Europeans are dragging their feet, and of course, by extension, the Americans are dragging their feet too. But ultimately, they have to recognize that this is a red line for Iran. We've already played this game once before. Last time round, they cheated us. We implemented the deal. What we did was verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency. They never implemented the deal. And then later on, they tore up the deal. So this time round, just like us, they have to go through a mechanism of verification, and they have to give us assurances that tomorrow we don't simply wake up and see that we're back in square one again.
Italy imposes new COVID restrictions on unvaccinated people amid harsh criticism for reopening schools. The new rules bar those who have not received their jabs from restaurants and domestic flights. This comes as schools in Italy have opened based on direct orders from the government. Head teachers, doctors, and some mayors have asked that classes be postponed for at least 2 weeks to stop COVID infections from growing. Due to the highly transmissible Omicron strain, Italy has been reporting record-breaking numbers of COVID cases since December. Omicron has forced countries across Europe to introduce new restrictions. Thousands have taken to the streets of Austria, Belgium, France, Germany, and the Netherlands to protest the new curbs. India is giving booster shots to its vulnerable groups in an attempt to tackle the escalating COVID-19 outbreak driven by the Omicron variant. Those eligible for a third dose are senior citizens and the country's frontline workers. India is getting close to last year's record COVID figures when thousands of people died in a single day. Despite the rapid surge, authorities say that only 5 to 10% of the cases need hospitalization now. They are, however, warning that the situation might change easily. India announced nearly 180,000 coronavirus infections on Monday. In Bangladesh, a fire sweeps through a Rohingya refugee camp in the country's southeast, destroying hundreds of homes. Government officials say that the blaze hit a camp in Cox's Bazar, where more than a million Rohingya refugees live. There are no immediate reports of casualties. The fire is now under control. The cause of the blaze is still unknown. A devastating fire there last March killed 15 people. Cox's Bazar has become the world's biggest refugee camp after the Rohingya took refuge there following a deadly military crackdown in Myanmar in 2017. The United Nations described the situation there a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Harsh winter has worsened already dire conditions of millions of Afghans who are struggling with hunger and poverty, especially those who have become homeless or displaced due to droughts or conflicts over the past months. Rahmatullah Bagban reports from Kabul.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we are visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiri, a mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
I am a widow and have several children. I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather and severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist them for receiving some aids.
Here you see internally displaced people from different provinces of Afghanistan. They are in urgent need of food and medicines. In addition, their tents are being collapsed due to rainfalls. We are enlisting for humanitarian aid, but it won't be sufficient for survival.
Bushra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gulzad Group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S. In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Moving on, senior Russian and U.S. officials are holding security talks in Geneva amid pessimism about the outcome of the discussions. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov and his U.S. counterpart Wendy Sherman are leading the delegations. The two sides also met on Sunday, a meeting that Ryabkov described as, quote, businesslike and difficult. Moscow has already ruled out making any concessions under pressure. Meanwhile, Washington says no breakthroughs are expected and that progress depends on de-escalation from Moscow. The Russians are also scheduled to hold high-level discussions with NATO and Europeans for new security arrangements. The NATO chief says that he does not have high expectations from the meetings.
But I don't think we can expect that these meetings will solve all the issues. What we are hoping for is that we can agree on a way forward, that we can agree on a series of meetings, that we can agree on the process. So it's not realistic to expect that when we have finished this week, when we have finished meetings that are already scheduled, that the problems will be solved.
Stoltenberg warned Russia of, quote, high political and economic costs if it attacks Ukraine. He said that NATO will continue to provide support for Ukraine and help it to uphold what he called the right for self-defense. The U.S.-led military alliance claims that Russia is building up troops along the border to attack Ukraine soon. Moscow denies the allegations, saying that its movement of troops is defensive as NATO is moving closer to its borders. Russia demands security guarantees that the military alliance will not expand further east. Researcher Greg Simmons is skeptical that the U.S. would remain committed to any security guarantees that it may offer Russia.
Even if under the extreme example that they do get the security guarantees, which I do not think they will, then will they abide by those security guarantees, which I doubt? Because if we remember back, Gorbachev received such security guarantees and they haven't been lived up to and they've been incrementally violated ever since. The problem stemming from the fact that the US considers itself the remaining superpower winner of the Cold War, so that it is the one that dictates the global order and these aspects of geopolitics and international relations. But this masks the fact that there is a massive transformation of these international relations and the global order, where the US is losing, in context, its position and influence.
Kazakhstan's president says that the deadly unrest of the recent days in his country has been an attempted coup.
A group of armed militants who were waiting in the wings joined the action. The main goal became obvious: the undermining of the constitutional order, the destruction of the institutions of government, the seizure of power. We are talking about an attempted coup d'etat.
Ilham Tokayev was addressing the leaders of a Russian-led military alliance in a video conference. Authorities say since the start of the widespread demonstrations over a week ago, over 160 people have been killed and nearly 8,000 arrested. That is in addition to security officers who were either killed or injured. Meanwhile, the Russian president stressed that the regional security alliance would not allow another color revolution to take place.
Of course, we understand the events in Kazakhstan are not the first and far from the last attempt to interfere in the internal affairs of our states from the outside. The measures taken by the CSTO military alliance have clearly shown that we will not allow the situation to be rocked at home and will not allow so-called color revolutions to take place.
Vladimir Putin said that CSTO peacekeepers will be in Kazakhstan for a limited time and would be withdrawn when the Kazakh president thought they were no longer needed. Kazakhstan's latest demonstrations following a hike in fuel prices marked the deadliest unrest in the country's post-Soviet history. Kazakh officials say the order has now been restored. Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip have expressed solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners who continue to languish in Israeli prisons. They also protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian inmates. Dr. Shannon brings us more in this report.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Abu Hamid was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, Wide Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian resistance will not leave the prisoners alone and will do all it can to secure their release. Resistance factions have secured the release of over 1,000 prisoners since 2011 and will force the Israeli regime to free more prisoners. Our enemy only understands the language of force. The Palestinian resistance will alleviate the suffering of Palestinian prisoners.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits.
I have been suffering for more than 30 years while waiting for my son to be free. When he was arrested, I was 40 years old, and now I am over 70. I pray to God to keep me alive so that one day I can hold my son in my arms. Every night, I cry myself to sleep worrying about my son.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors.
We are extremely worried about our sons and daughters inside Israeli jails. My son has been in jail for 7 years and I was able to visit him only twice. The situation inside Israeli prisons is extremely difficult and all Palestinian prisoners are suffering, especially due to medical negligence and the inhumane treatment.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. People here are demanding international protection for Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. The beautiful sound of azan, the call to prayers. In front of my house, there is a small mosque which has two tall minarets and blue tile work. On top of each of the minarets, green light turns on around the sunset time. The combination of the sound of azan and the green light on top of the minarets make a spiritual atmosphere which makes me calm. It's interesting to note that minaret or mil is an Iranian structure that has entered the Islamic architecture. Today, we are going to take a trip to Khorasan Razavi province, to Firuzabad village. We are going to visit Firuzabad Mil. Minaret or Mil literally means the place of light and brightness. In ancient Iran, minaret or Mil was built for guiding travelers. These mills were built on the sides of roads and routes. People used to set fire on top of the mills so that caravans or travelers could spot the light in dark of the night or during foggy days so that they would not be lost. These structures were built separately and were not attached to any building nearby. The oldest mill in Iran is known as Mile Ejdaha, which dates back to the Parthian era, and is located in Mamasani region of Fars province. In contrast to other mills, which are cylindrical and brick-made, this mill is rectangular and made of stone. There are over 30 mills in Iran today, which most of them date back to the 4th to 6th century AH. Firuzabad Mill, or Firuzabad Tower, dates back to Seljuqid era. I am now at Firuzabad village. This village is located in a dry, desert-like area. From the point I'm standing, I can see the Firuzabad mill. I have to take a walk for about 5 minutes in order to see it from a closer view. I am now standing beside the Firuzabad mill. This mill consists of three parts: the base, the body, and the top. Inside the body, there is a staircase and a light well. This mill is cylindrical and is 18 meters high. However, it used to be 24 meters in the past, and now just 18 meters of it has remained. Firuzabad Mill has two layers and is made of bricks. The architecture of this building is known as Razi style. Oh my God! The brick decorations of this structure are great! There are two inscriptions at the top and bottom of the mill. These inscriptions have been written in Kufi script, so I can't read it. Kufi calligraphy is used in the decorations of buildings and tile works a lot because it's so beautiful. There used to be a spiral staircase inside this mill, which has been damaged by the passage of time. If it was here now, I would go up the stairs and look around from the top of the mill. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
He is one of the youngest presidents of a country. Gabriel Boric has been elected into office in Chile, promising an orderly economy. But what is that? Is he going to pull Chile's economy out of the one that has led it to be one of the most unequal countries in the world? Hi, I'm Kavita Halfway. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide, where we will look at Chile's economic future under its new president. Coming up, Chile's new president, his economic plans, promise to install a welfare state, to expand social rights, but to do so with fiscal responsibility. Will that help pull Chile out of its economic downturn? Also, we will take a look at Chile's inequality, one of the world's most unequal nations. But why, when it has an abundance of natural resources like copper, not to mention lithium? Also, we're going to take a look at a trend that is happening in Latin America. Boric is one of a handful of Latin American leaders who has come from the left. Why is Latin America seeing a rise of the left? Also, something that has been noticed in Peru. And the big one is possibly to come in Brazil.
It was an election that just months ago did not foresee the rise of a 35-year-old to the highest job in the country. But that is what happened. Gabriel Boric, a former student leader, won the presidential election in Chile with 55% of the vote. He describes himself as a moderate socialist who will seek to maintain fiscal discipline as he advances his reforms. Some of these reforms include raising taxes on the rich, raising taxes on the mining industry, rejecting projects that damage the environment, improving social services, dismantling the private pension system, which is why you have economists looking at Chile's economic future with pessimism.
When Chile's new president-elect won the elections, it looked like Wall Street was attacking him because of his liberal policies, economically speaking, with many headlines sounding off the alarm on his win. Like this one, president-elect Boric aims to undo Chile's economic progress. The Wall Street Journal said his wish list included ending private pensions. It would destroy Chile's capital markets. Now, this headline was a no-holds-barred display of using scare tactics. Aside from saying how Chile's stock market and currency have fallen, It went on to say that the new president would oppose some mining projects and would govern a divided Congress. There's about 5 negative points in this particular descriptions. And if that wasn't enough, the article goes on to describe Boric as the leader of a left-wing coalition, which included the Chilean Communist Party, further describing Boric as bearded and tattooed 35-year-old former student leader. But Boric's critics were in for a surprise. As of December 31st, Bloomberg reported that Chile's unemployment rate had fallen for the 8th straight month, reaching levels last seen before the pandemic. The jobless rate fell to 7.5% between September and November, and retail sales in November grew 16.7%, lower than expected. Well, joining us for this segment is Carlos Patricio Gonzalez. Now, he's got a rather long resume here, which is noteworthy for us to highlight. He's a senior lecturer at London South Bank University in the UK. He's also a Chilean former political prisoner of Pinochet regime, exiled in Britain as a result. Expertise he has in urbanism, architecture, and technology design at City Resilience. And currently, he's doing research into homelessness in Chile with a sabbatical during 2022 to research the plight of people in homeless dwellers, emergency camps in Santiago and in Valparaiso. All right, well, welcome, a warm welcome to you, Carlos, and thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide. We're looking at Chile's new president-elect in terms of his, what he has called fiscal discipline. He wants to enact reforms that he has said, like raising taxes on the rich and also on the mining industry, rejecting projects that are not too climate-friendly when it comes to that. And also, we're looking at how he wants to dismantle the pension system. Are these promised reforms actually realistic? Do you think he'll be able to do them?
It will depend. It will depend on several factors. There are talks now by the forces that support Gabriel Boric with other center-left forces like the socialists, the Christian Democrats, etc., who they were in government in the recent years, especially the government of Michelle Bachelet in the past, in order to broaden the support for the changes. Now, especially when we are encountering a parliament recently elected, it's almost even, slight advantages for the left on the lower chamber, but equally divided in the higher chamber. So there are even talks to right-wing moderate forces in the parliament in order to pass legislation, because many of the policies that Boric bring in to the front need to be passed through parliament, especially tax reforms, the end of the pension system, new health services system, etc.
All right, very good. Let's see what Dennis Small thinks. Let me bring him in. Dennis Small is a Latin America editor at the Executive Intelligence Review. Dennis Small, welcome to Economic Divide. We're looking at the Chilean new president-elect and some of the promises that he has made, such as eliminating the pension system or rejecting projects, especially in the industrial sector, that are not climate-friendly, not to mention raising taxes on the rich. Do you think that he's going to actually be able to execute these promised reforms, especially, obviously, ones that he ran during his presidential campaign?
Well, I think he will certainly attempt to lessen the divide, but again, Chile is a little bit of a microcosm of the whole world. Over the last 2 years of the pandemic and the 10 years since the last crisis, the inequality worldwide has grown phenomenally, where the vulgarly rich have become extremely vulgarly rich, and there is broader impoverishment, hunger, and disease around the world, with some countries facing potential starvation of the majority of their population, such as Afghanistan. That said, I think that Chile does have potential to move in the direction of lessening that divide. Chile is a young country on top of everything else. It's not only is the president young at 35, but the population that voted for him is generally quite young. And the party system, the existing institutional parties have been very badly defeated in this election, which means that people are looking for a new and different way out. I think a lot of Boric's success or not will depend on him providing a mission, a sense of national purpose, especially to the young in the country. And in this regard, one of the most promising areas, in my view, especially to the degree which the Belt and Road extends itself through South America, and Chile becomes part of that, with Argentina and Brazil after the elections and others.
Hello and welcome to our first InfoNews section of the year. And we are going to start off this section with a piece of news that shows the U.S. double standards in full display. Now, this piece of crypto news was an eye-opener. It said that the U.S. government has a huge secret crypto stockpile that it had been seizing and then auctioning off cryptocurrencies, and this was in a span of years. It had gained so much steam that it enlisted the help of the private sector to manage the storage and the sales of its hoard of tokens. So much for the U.S. being against crypto and Bitcoin in particular. Moving on to our next piece, it's the holiday season for Americans, but many are not in a festive mood, as evident from this headline. 21 million Americans don't have enough to eat this holiday season. This is especially true for the ones who are in the low-income category. Low-income families may soon face additional pressures as monthly child tax credit payments are ending. Not good news for, obviously, low-income Americans in the U.S. And staying with the U.S. for our next piece, this headline posed the question, what's driving higher prices? The answer, unchecked corporate power. But the real reason for inflation is the increasing concentration of the American economy into the hands of a few. And who are the few? They are the corporate giants with the power to raise prices. After all, they need to make up for the losses that were incurred during the pandemic. And our final piece, in the growing competition between the U.S. and China, China has unveiled new plans to spearhead robot revolution. Automation plans have come amid escalating tech rivalry with the United States. Now, its goal to digitize the operations of 70% of its domestic manufacturers by the year 2025.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
In this in-depth section, we will look at the rise of the left in Latin America, especially now that Chile's new president-elect, Gabriel Boric, has swept into power. But is there really a surge in leftist parties? Well, for starters, what is the meaning of left-wing in politics? Taking a look at the definition, the left refers to people and groups that actually have what's called liberal or revolutionary views. This can include communism or it can even include socialism. Meanwhile, the word right, in contrast, it refers to people or groups that have conservative views. It also can include extreme nationalistic viewpoints. Okay? All right. Now, in our case, our focus is the left. Is there a rise of the left in America? That answer is a resounding yes. It began with the win of Manuel López Obrador, the Mexican president, back in 2018. Xiomara Castro, the Honduran president, which became the first female president, is another example. Moving on to Pedro Castillo, Peru's president, who saw a narrow win in the presidency there. And of course, Gabriel Boric, the Chilean president-elect, which has come into power, a subject of this program. And now there are speculations on this man, Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, to become Brazil's next president. That's a big win, obviously, for him if that happens. Now, comparisons are already being made to the icons who are described as anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist. They need no description, really. I'm sure these figures are familiar to you. The late Fidel Castro, the late Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro of Cuba, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, and of course, you have at the end there the Bolivian former president, Evo Morales. Now, why are people in Latin America actually voting for candidates to the left instead of a conservative government or ones to the right? Well, in short, raging poverty is one of the reasons, which is fanned by the COVID-19 pandemic now, which has actually pushed people to the left or to choose candidates that are from the left. People want a leader that not only promises economic prosperity, but this is important. They want an economic overhaul. I mean, they want the system changed. They are favoring economic overhaul over the bigger government and higher social spending, which has not given them economic prosperity. At the same time, people are rising up to reclaim their democracies and also to reclaim their constitution. Well, in the case of Chile, one is actually being written. Okay, rejoining us in this section is Dennis Small, Latin American editor at Executive Intelligence Review. Dennis, welcome back. We're looking at left-wing forces that are gaining ground in Latin America, the focus of this section over here. You're having elections being won by what's called the leftist candidates who are now presidents from Honduras to Peru, for example. Now, Brazil is supposed to be the next big one. Why has this occurred? Is that a sign of defeat for the Western economic model, do you think?
Yes, it is definitely a sign of defeat for the Western economic model. The question remains is, will there be a viable positive alternative in place to replace it? The simple defeat of an existing system and its institutions does not necessarily mean that the future will be bright. We could also descend into an era of extreme chaos, wars, and collapse of different forms. But there's no question but that the existing institutions, the parties, and other political forms across Ibero-America have been vastly discredited under the conditions of the crisis. And that has everything to do with the fact that the system in the transatlantic sector is in fact coming down. The neoliberal economic model has failed tremendously, and it's just getting worse under the conditions of the pandemic that's now underway.
Let's bring in Carlos Gonzalez. He joins us, the senior lecturer at London SoftBank University, to see what he thinks. Carlos Gonzalez, we just heard our guest there, Dennis Small. We're talking about the left-wing forces that are regaining control in Latin America. Do you agree that that's indeed happening? Is that a sign of defeat for the Western economic model, do you think?
I don't think neither at the moment. Neither of the two suggestions, the end or sign of defeat or triumph of Western economic model. We have to remember that the economic model that we got in Chile is called neoliberalism, which comes directly from Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom, put together in Chile by the Chicago Boys, which took the economic part of the government of the dictatorship, Pinochet dictatorship, and they imposed the trinity of free market trinity, what we call privatization, deregulation, and cutting social spending.
He faces many challenges ahead. The split Congress, meaning no majority there, the sharp economic slowdown, although it could be short-term, and the writing of a new constitution. A split Congress is going to be a tricky one to handle. He will need to negotiate and make deals and alliances. And this could weaken his appeal among backers with high expectations of rapid change. For one of the most unequal countries in the world, Boric made some promises which were part of his appeal towards a win. He said we cannot continue to allow the poor to pay for the inequalities of Chile, adding we will reach out and build bridges so our citizens can live a better life.
When it comes to Chile, one thing stands out about this country in particular, and that is the abundant mineral wealth. Take copper, for example. Did you know that Chile is the number one producer of copper in the entire world? The country has been the world's top copper producer now for over three decades, and today, close to 50% of the country's exports come from copper-related products. Now comes the next natural resource that Chile has, which is in great demand worldwide. Can you guess? Well, it's lithium. You know, the stuff used in batteries for portable devices. Chile comes in second after Australia and before China when it comes to lithium production. But when it comes to the reserves, it's another story. Chile has the largest amount of lithium reserves in the world, outweighing Australia by a lot, as seen here. With these top two natural reserves in a possession of Chile, you might say it should be a rich country. Yet, Chile is one of the most unequal countries in the world. By unequal, we are referring to income inequality. Looking at this snapshot, which covers years 2014 to 2020, inequality is at around 52%. Simply put, richest earned around 52% more than the rest. So, will Chile's new president, Gabriel Boric, spread the wealth with all these natural resources that are moneymakers? That should happen, but there is a catch. You see, Boric ran on a platform of clean energy. The incoming president has been passed the rewriting of the constitution. The country is currently writing a new constitution to tackle a climate and ecological emergency. The new constitution places the future of the country's climate readiness in the hands of its 155 architects. Well, that does it for this section. I do appreciate any comments or questions that you may have. Our links and addresses are in front of you now. From me, Matty, it's goodbye until next week.
The win by Gabriel Boric is an important one for Chile. Given the vast natural resources that this country has, well, he's got the opportunity to make life for many Chileans across the spectrum, especially for the poor and even the middle class, better, albeit through a model that is climate friendly. But the bigger picture here is the rise of the left in Latin America, or better yet, the defeat of the Western economic model. Now, maybe the model might have been sound economically, but the people at the helm, steered by the West, like the U.S., failed where it mattered the most, and that is the people. That is for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. From Ikovitakwe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.